Morning, everybody. We're going to get started. This morning, I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Jonathan Waxman, who is a thoracic surgeon here on staff at Boca Regional Hospital. Dr. Waxman comes from Mexico City, where he went to medical school, and then he did his internship and residency at Beth Israel in Boston. He subsequently has done fellowships at the University of Tennessee and also the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And Dr. Waxman is going to talk to us about an update on lung cancer from a surgical standpoint.
Thank you.
Everybody can hear me okay, right? Good morning. I'm very happy to be here this morning to talk to you about lung cancer and in particular about surgery for lung cancer in the era of personalized medicine. I'm going to be talking particularly about non-small cell lung cancer, so keep that in mind as we go along our slides. And I just want to start by saying that a lot of changes have happened in the last few years. We don't treat lung cancer the same way we used to treat it 3, 5, 8 years ago. So everything has changed dramatically, and it's really an exciting time to be involved with the management of lung cancer. So this is what it's going to boil down to for personalized medicine. So a patient is going to come into the office, and he's going to get his one particular treatment, and it's going to be different for every patient. Background for in regards of lung cancer, we all know that lung cancer is just a bad disease, and it's the number one cancer killer in the United States, to the point that it's actually more lethal than colon, breast, and pancreas combined. It's thought to be a smoker's disease, but in reality, it's much more complex than that. 60% of patients that develop lung cancer are former smokers, 20% current smokers, but as many as almost 20% never smoked. So some numbers right now, 432 is the number of Americans that die of lung cancer every day. 70 is the mean age at diagnosis, 72 the mean age at death, and almost 17% is a five-year survival for patients with lung cancer. Just keep in mind this last number is taking into account all comers, all stages. So it is a really bad disease. As mentioned, takes more lives than breast, colon, and pancreas cancers combined. Interestingly enough, is one of the most underfunded cancers in terms of research or NIH research-wise. 50% are diagnosed before they show any spread, as opposed to or in comparison to prostate, about 80% and 60% breast. So one can understand one of the many reasons why it's so lethal. And then not making use of these lung cancer screening tools that we have nowadays also makes this number not change, unfortunately. A little bit of gender differences. Lung cancer kills more women than any other cancer. And it overtook breast cancer as the leading cause of cancer death in women, probably since the late 1980s. Claims more lives of women than breast, ovarian, or cervical and cervical cancer combined. Interestingly, also 20% of women with lung cancer never smoked, as opposed to 10% in men. And the majority of secondhand smokers who die from lung cancer are women. So now we're going to talk a little bit about about mutations or molecular studies. And this is where I'm going to link lung cancer management and personalized medicine. So now lung cancer, we not only classify it as non-small cell adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, but now every patient is pretty much getting a molecular profile in terms of or depending on what type of mutations the cancer cells have. And I'm going to talk to you about the most common mutations in clinical practice right now. I'm not going to talk about immunotherapy. That's a whole different topic at this point. But these are the three most common mutations that we test for, and I'm just going to briefly talk to you about each one of them. We have the EGFR, ALK, and KRAS. And specifically, before I go on, in addition to these three mutations, you can see on the bottom part of the slide, there's a whole array, a whole bunch of other mutations that we test for, some of them with active clinical use, some of them as part of research or clinical protocols, and some of them being looked at down the pipeline. But these mutations happen in adenocarcinomas, and adenocarcinoma is the most frequent type of non-small cell lung cancer, and this is very important as we keep going down our talk. EGFR mutations. So they're found, EGFR receptors are found on the surface of epithelial cells. They're overexpressed in certain malignancies, lung cancer being one of them. There's many mutations or many types of EGFR mutations, but the most common ones are the 19 deletion and the 21-point mutation. Their presence are predictive of response to treatment, and they're considered sensitizing mutations. There's primary and secondary resistance. Primary resistance is usually associated to another mutation, which is a KRAS mutation and the ALK rearrangement. Secondary resistance is usually from developing another mutation, which is the T790M. And as many as 60% of patients who develop resistance after initiating TKI treatment develop this type of mutation. And again, the secondary resistance. Resistance can develop anywhere between 8 to 16 months after treatment. Some patients go on having more prolonged response before they develop resistance. This slide just shows pretty much what is the prevalence of EGFR mutation in different groups of patients. Usually Asians have it more than white. And women and non-smokers are the ones that tend to have these EGFR mutations. Now, what is the significance of having one or several of these mutations? Well, as mentioned to you, patients respond better to treatment when they have these mutations, and actually having some of them are prognostic markers for survival. So in this study, comparing TKI, which is tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that's a medication that we use to treat the patients that have these mutations. Patients that are treated with TKIs actually have a better response than patients that are treated with chemotherapy, and they have a better prolonged free survival. Just a little note, that doesn't always correlate with overall survival. That's being looked into right now, and one of the reasons why overall survival might not be improved could be due to CNS recurrence. But overall, there's better progression-free survival in patients treated, patients that have this mutation and that are treated with the TKIs as opposed to conventional chemotherapy. Another receptor, ALK, it's a gene rearrangement fusion with other genes, particularly EML4, present in 2 to 7% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. The presence of this mutation signifies a resistance to TKIs, so that's why it's important to test for this. Usually happens more likely in men and patients of a younger age group, and can be present in it's present in adenocarcinomas and also tumors with mixed histology, such as adenosquamous carcinomas. But it does not happen in squamous carcinomas, and as you can tell here, they looked for ALK rearrangement in many patients. There were zero patients with ALK rearrangements that had squamous cell carcinoma. Another mutation, KRAS, you've heard about this one, usually present in as many as 25% of patients, can be associated with smoking. It is a prognostic biomarker for shorter survival and can overlap with the EGFR mutation in as many as 1% of patients. So what do we do with this information? So now we test for these mutations as a standard of care. As you can see by the NCCN guidelines, you can these are accessible on the web, very easy to find out. But now testing for EGFR, the ALK, is standard of care, particularly for those patients, obviously, as mentioned, that have adenocarcinoma or adenosquamous carcinoma. We also, or it is also recommended to test for this mutation for those patients when we have small tissue samples where adenocarcinoma cannot be excluded. And this is important as we're going to talk in the next few slides about procuring tissue and the importance of that and the role of surgery in that. But just continuing the standard of care, a few years ago, any patient diagnosed with advanced disease would go on to have chemotherapy, Now the standard of care is if those patients are mutated, they're going to receive a TKI as a first line of treatment. So again, this is a significant change in practice. The American Society of Clinical Oncology and these other three institutions endorse certain recommendations in regards of testing, as mentioned to you. Now, whenever we are treating a patient with lung cancer, when we're diagnosing a patient, we're staging him, we have to think about these mutations because now they're part of the clinical care. So the recommendations are to test in all patients with advanced stage adenocarcinoma or a cancer that has an adenocarcinoma component. Remember I mentioned to you about the mutations and their presence in adenocarcinomas. Small tumor samples of other histologies where adenocarcinoma cannot be excluded. Both primary tumors and metastatic lesions are suitable for testing. This is actually a very important point because now things are getting more complex. Not all the tumors have the same molecular pattern. So you can have a patient that has a primary lung cancer with a metastasis in the lung or extrathoracic metastasis, and we think that the tumor marker profile may not necessarily be the same between the primary and the metastasis, and this has a very significant clinical implication for treatment and follow-up. So should we test all patients with lung cancer, not only the advanced stage ones, but the early stage ones? Well, it depends on what institution one is at. And the other question is there any cost-benefit in testing early? The advantage of testing all patients, even the patients that have early stage cancer, is that there can be a rapid initiation of therapy if early recurrence. There's a lot of clinical trials ongoing using these tyrosine kinase inhibitors in the neoadjuvant setting followed by surgery or neo and adjuvant with surgery in the middle and for long-term follow-up. So in those centers, you know, testing is done early. But again, the issue is the cost. And in this day and age, obviously, we have to keep that in mind. And I came across actually a very interesting study. This was done in 2015, so it's very recent. And it looks at the cost effectiveness of multiplex predictive biomarker screening. So what we do now is we don't test necessarily for just one mutation, but we actually use a panel that looks for several mutations at the same time, and this has proven to be more cost effective than just going and looking or screening for only one mutation. But in this particular study, what they did is they took literature looking at outcomes from patients undergoing treatment with chemotherapy and TKIs. And what they did is they did a simulation, and they divided the patients into four groups using this simulation. The patients that weren't tested and they went straight to chemotherapy. Patients that were on the empiric therapy group, so they would get four cycles of chemotherapy, and then depending on what molecular markers they had, they would receive treatment. Then the patients on the empiric switch therapy, they would receive one cycle of chemotherapy, and then if they were mutated, they would receive a TKI, and the test to treat. So those patients did not receive chemotherapy. They were diagnosed, they were tested, and once the test result came back, if they were mutated, they would receive a TKI. And once they did the very sophisticated cost-effective analysis, it turns out that the test to treat was the most cost-effective therapy. So again, supporting why we one of the arguments supporting what why we do what we do or why we treat the way we treat. These are the patients that get diagnosed, they get tested for mutations, and then if they're mutated, they go on to receive a TKI. So the NCCN guidelines for diagnosis and staging of lung cancer and all other guidelines for the like the ACCP, the American College of Chest Physicians, they tell us what type of tests we can use to diagnose and stage lung cancer. We can use sputum cytology and bronchoscopy, and again, thoracentesis, for example. We're not going to talk about those, but we're going to talk about the invasive staging procedures. We're going to talk about image-guided, like CT-guided biopsy, VATS, mediastinoscopy, EBUS, and navigational bronchoscopy. And the reason why I want to talk about these ones in particular is this is where the link between surgery, or one of the many places where the link between surgery and personalized medicine nowadays takes place. As a surgeon, our role is not only to diagnose patients anymore. Before, we would do a nevus on a patient, and whenever we got a diagnosis of cancer, then we would be done. Now, just getting the diagnosis is not enough. Now, our role is to ensure that there's enough tissue to perform all the testing required. And this is another area where now the pathologist takes an integral role in the management of the patient, whereas before it had more of a passive role, just get the tissue, make a diagnosis. Now the pathologist has a very important say in the treatment because the pathologist has to communicate with us and we have to communicate with the pathologist in terms of not only diagnosis but the quality of the tissue and the amount of the tissue procured. Once more, it is recommended that adequate tissue be obtained to not only define the histologic type, but also to be able to perform mutation analysis studies. So CT-guided biopsy, we're all familiar with this. A transthoracic needle aspirate or needle biopsy can be done under fluoro, but now in this day and age, we do it under CT-guided imaging. And the patient, it's an outpatient procedure. The patient goes to the CT scan machine. The interventional radiologist localizes the lesion, advances a needle, whether it's a skinny needle or a core needle, and then they get some tissue. Again, a needle or a skinny needle or a core can be used. It's done as an outpatient most of the times, done by the interventional radiologist. Very good or reasonable sensitivity. FNA versus core, actually they are equally sensitive in making a diagnosis. The core is better, though, when one has a suspicion or wants to rule out benign disease, like a granuloma, for example, a fungal infection. False positive rate is very low, and the core does actually yield more tissue, which is important when we're looking at mutation analysis. Complications, well, bleeding. Is something that we always keep in mind. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often, but when it happens, it can be pretty significant, and as many as 18% of patients may require a blood transfusion. Pneumothorax, 15%. This 15% number is from the data looking at fine needle aspirates. With core needle biopsies, probably this number is higher, as obviously the needle is bigger. Out of these 15% of patients, 7% may require a chest tube, and these patients, some of them may require an admission, so something to keep in mind. And patients who are in this age group, 60 to 69, smokers and COPD, which is pretty much almost all our patients, they have a high risk of developing a complication. This is data from, from the ACCP guidelines. So it's a little bit of old data, 2013, I think. But that shows the good sensitivity and specificity of CT-guided biopsy, 90 and 97%. So it is a very good test to make a diagnosis of lung cancer. Let's switch now to the surgical area. Mediastinoscopy is the gold standard against we compare the mediastinal invasive techniques. It's usually done in the operating room under general endotracheal anesthesia, usually done as an outpatient, same-day discharge, very low morbidity, and should have very, very low mortality in experienced hands. Sensitivity, 66 to 93%. It's probably higher, and it's definitely institution and operator dependent. If you have an aggressive surgeon, those numbers are going to be better. Specificity is very good, and you can see the additional values. So we do now not mediastinoscopy, but video mediastinoscopy, and believe it or not, it does have an advantage. It's easier on the surgeon, easier on the operating team, but also it allows for more accurate dissection of the mediastinal compartment. The video mediastinoscope looks like a little gun, as you can tell. This is the optic and video cable. They go in the handle. And then this is the working channel of the mediastinoscope, of the video mediastinoscope. This is the end that goes in through a small incision at the base of the neck into the pretracheal space. So this is a little video. Many of you may have seen this video before from other presentations. The trachea is the white structure right here. This is the mediastinal tissues to the right and to the left. If you go in a straight line down here, you get to the pulmonary artery and the heart. You got the azygos vein and cava on this side. So after the dissection is done, then this is the lymph node that is being dissected with this instrument. This instrument is a combination of cautery and suction, and obviously allows for mechanical, allows for dissection in such a way. Then with a cotton tip applicator, the lymph node can be better defined. So this is done through the camera. Imagine in the old days, you know, without the video, the surgeon had to look down a tiny little hole and try to pray that he was actually dissecting the real thing. Then spinal needle is used to make sure that the structure is not a vessel, which they can look very similar, believe it or not, especially if you have an engorged vein or tributary. And then with a long tip biopsy forceps, then the lymph node is removed. Most of the times we try to remove the entire lymph node. Sometimes that cannot be done safely, so we try to remove as much of the lymph node as possible. And through this technique, actually most of the mediastinal stations can be reached, the stations 2, stations 4, so those are the right and left paratracheal stations, 7, which is the subcarinal. You can even go to the hilar lymph nodes if you're aggressive enough as well. So it is a great diagnostic and staging technique, and I'm going to make emphasis on that point as I go down the slides. Now we're going to switch and we're going to talk about endobronchial ultrasound. Endobronchial ultrasound is done using a bronchoscope, a flexible bronchoscope, but the bronchoscope actually has an ultrasound transducer at its tip. The difference between a regular bronchoscope is with this one, we don't have a straight view, but we have a 45-degree view. So obviously the operator needs to be very familiar with bronchoscopy. And a 75-degree forward oblique view with the ultrasound. And then, so what you have, this is the image, this is the regular white light image, and this is the ultrasonographic view. In this little picture here, you can see what the needle looks like as it's going into a lymph node. These are probably blood vessels. So what do we use in the bronchial ultrasound for? We use it also for diagnosis and staging. It allows access to all the nodal stations that I mentioned. It's a minimally invasive modality. It's done as an outpatient. It can be done under sedation or in the operating room. Under sedation or under general endotracheal anesthesia. Here, we do it in the operating room because it's very important when one is doing an EBUS, particularly in a patient that has suspicious mediastinal nodes either by CT scan or by PET scan, a negative EBUS needs to have a confirmatory mediastinoscopy. So by having the patients in the operating room, we can convert at the same time, as opposed to having the patient in the bronchoscopy suite, sending the patient home, and then having to bring the patient back if the result is discordant with the clinical picture. It's a real-time procedure. We have the ability of using Doppler to differentiate lymph nodes from vessels. Widespread of use. It's actually now standard of care and has been for the last several years. And its use has proven to be very beneficial because numbers are pretty good in terms of yield and sensitivity. But also, it saves patients unnecessary procedures, mediastinoscopy or even thoracotomies. Clinical applications, as mentioned, we use it for diagnosis and staging, but it's very important because we use it now not only to stage and to diagnose, but we use it as a technique to procure tissue when we're looking for mutation studies. Obviously, a CT-guided biopsy is very useful for that. Mediastinoscopy, well, doesn't get any better than that. I mean, if you have a malignant lymph node and you're getting it out, you really got a good amount of tissue. But is EBUS good? To obtain tissue? And the answer is it is, actually. Now, more than before, as we have now core needles, we have 22 and 25 core needles, as before we used to use just regular needles. And the core needle is actually a great, is of a great design. It has a little indentation, a little channel or cutting channel right here. So as the needle advances and you go back and forth, tissue is being captured through this little sharp slit, and the tissue is being accumulated inside of the needle. So works great. Is there any difference between a 22 and a 25? Well, a little depends on the clinical implication and what your pathologist is telling you. Again, this is one of the areas that you need to communicate with the pathologist constantly. So if you have a pathologist that it's not in tune with what's happening, that can be deleterious to the patient. This is an example of an image. This is a fused PET CT scan. This is a posterior tracheal mediastinal lymph node. And then this patient went on to have an EBUS and had a core. You can see the really good amount of tissue. This is a very populated sample. And now, not only do we just look at morphology, the pathologist not only does he look at the morphology of the slide, but he does immunostains. So you can see these are markers that they test for that are prevalent in adenocarcinoma, for example. Another example of a patient that has a lung mass and a mediastinal lymph node. This is actually, this slide I wanted to put it not only to demonstrate about EBUS and its efficacy, but this brings another important point. In clinical practice, if we have a patient that has a positive mediastinum and a lung mass and is suspicious for lung cancer, many of these patients may go to be sent to have a CT-guided needle biopsy. There's nothing wrong with that. But one thing to keep in mind, and this is where talking to the quote-unquote team or the multidisciplinary team taking care of lung cancer patients is helpful. This patient, just by guidelines, he's going to require a bronchoscopy with endobronchial ultrasound. So many of these patients that are going to require that, that study, as mentioned, can be used for diagnostic and staging procedures at the same time. So we sometimes can obviate or we can help the save the patient a procedure such as a CT-guided biopsy. I'm not saying that CT-guided biopsies are not indicated, but it's useful to take to look at the big picture and better if you understand how we manage these patients so we can order the adequate tests and try to be a little bit, cost-effective and minimize risk to the patient. In this case, this patient had an EBUS, had a sample done, and in addition to the regular immunostains, now, as mentioned, we look at molecular testing and we do a whole panel of several mutations, try to see which ones the patients have. So therefore, we obtain a mutation profile of the patient's tumor. EBUS biopsy has a great sensitivity and negative predictive value. It's a very, very, very safe procedure. Pneumothorax is the most common complication, and it's very rare to have this. No mortality. Agitation, cough, and blood at the puncture site, those are not really complications. Those are just something to be expected after any EBUS procedure. In addition to the biopsy, just as a little extra, we not only try to do a biopsy, but we also try to get an idea of what the lymph node looks like, because depending on its ultrasonographic characteristics, we can predict if a lymph node is going to be malignant or not. This is particularly useful for lymph nodes that may be seen at the time of EBUS, but might not be safely reached. For example, if you have an enlarged lymph node and you have a big blood vessel in between the transducer and the lymph node, well, that would be kind of risky to biopsy it, but we have other ways to try to figure out if the lymph node is malignant. This is a slide just showing an example of where the lymph node, a far right lymph node would be, for example. Here's a CT scan. I actually took these slides from the virtual bronchoscopy lecture, but I thought they were very cool in showing at the time of bronchoscopy where the lymph node would be. And if you can imagine, if you don't have endobronchial ultrasound or ENB, you know, you could, bronchoscopists could try to do a biopsy of this area, but in reality it would be a blind procedure. Having said that, there are extremely skilled bronchoscopists that can do biopsies without ultrasound and without ENB and have great yields. But now that we have the technology, there's really no reason not to use it. So what happens is once we identify an abnormal lymph node on a CT or on a PET-CT scan, we advance the bronchoscope, and the operator has an idea of where the ultrasound is directed towards. You can imagine you make a mental picture of where the lymph node is and the plane of scanning from your ultrasound transducer. And here you can see, you can easily identify the lymph node, and you can easily identify the big blood vessel behind it. So it's very, very accurate in terms of letting you know how to advance the needle and other technicalities as to how many passes and technique, et cetera. And again, once more, this is what it looks like, the needle going through the lymph node. You can tell vascular structures, the left atrium in this case, so very accurate, very safe. Diagnostic yield for molecular analysis, this has been looked has been looked into, and the EBUS is a good technique that yields adequate sampling for molecular testing, with numbers high in the 90s, probably higher, again, depending on the institution and some other technical factors as the size of the lymph node, et cetera. Comparing EBUS with CT-guided biopsy, they're both equally as good in obtaining tissue for molecular testing. Let's talk now about endobronchial navigational bronchoscopy or bronchoscopic biopsy. This is a technique that uses electromagnetic energy, and what we do is we obtain a dedicated CT scan and we couple it to the patient's anatomy in live time in the operating room. We do it under general anesthesia as well. And again, we have a big machine. We do some planning right before the patient goes to sleep. And again, we couple the patient's scan to the patient's anatomy. And then we make a plan, and then we follow that plan or pathway towards the lesion. And then we can advance, not a needle, but we can actually advance a regular biopsy or a miniature biopsy forceps into the target area. So the ENB allows us to reach farther than conventional bronchoscopy. And, for example, you have a peripheral lesion, so you have two options. You can go from the outside in with a core needle, a CT-guided needle biopsy, or now you can go from the inside out with this technology, which is actually proven to be very safe. The risk of pneumothorax with this technique is about 6% or as high as 6% as opposed to higher with other transthoracic approaches. This is just an example of what the procedure looks like. Here we have a left lower lobe tumor, which is marked and targeted by the machine. And then at the time of the procedure, we really just generate a virtual path. And what we do is we just follow the line. It's actually fairly easy. We also use fluoroscopy to aid in this, particularly once we reach the target. With fluoroscopy, we just ensure that our biopsy forceps open. If we use a needle, we can see how far we are advancing it to try to keep from getting into trouble. But again, the procedure is fairly straightforward. We just follow the target line. You can see here where we are. Now we get into the division between the upper and the lower lobe. We make the turn pretty much where the machine tells us. And literally, it's like GPS-like technology, and we try to get as close to the target as possible. We confirm with fluoroscopy, and then we go ahead and do the biopsies needed. What is the diagnostic yield of ENB? It's not great, and it depends on many technical factors, where the tumor is located, where there's a bronchus sign. Is there a bronchus actually leading into where the tumor is? But the yield is fairly acceptable, 71%. Molecular studies? Do we get enough tissue for molecular studies? Well, we do. We're actually using large needles, biopsy forceps, so when we hit the right target, we get enough tissue to do molecular testing. Let's talk about minimally invasive lung surgery or VATS surgery. Well, we can use the VATS to obtain, that's the ultimate way to obtain tissue because we take the entire tumor out. We can do a wedge, we can do a lobectomy, but we can also do other things like pleural biopsies. We use one, two, three, sometimes as many as four small incisions on the side of the patient. You know, the patients, from a cosmetic standpoint, the patients don't have a big scar. But more importantly, the patients have much decreased amount of pain, much less use of narcotics. Early, they recover faster. And if they need to obtain treatment, they can get it faster because they really don't have to. The recovery is actually very, it's quicker than with conventional surgery. Wedge resection for small peripheral lesions, we can actually take them out almost in an outpatient setting. Here, because of the type of patient population we have, usually patients end up staying overnight. But this really can be done as an outpatient, and it can be done very easily. Once we identify the target lesion, we use this thoracoscopic stapler that cuts and delivers two rows of staples, one on each side, sealing the lung tissue. And once the tumor is identified and amputated, it's placed in a bag and then just taken out. So as opposed to just having a needle, aspirate, or a core biopsy, we can actually take the entire tumor out and allows for excellent mutation profiling. And this is going to be very important because I'm going to mention down in a few more slides, surgery, or the role of surgery, is not only to cure or to try to cure patients with early stage disease. But now surgery has a role in the treatment of patients with metastatic cancer as well. We can use surgery to go for mediastinal nodes that look abnormal. This is a level 5 or AP window lymph node. This is the left lung being retracted posteriorly. The heart is in the, and the aorta is in the front. You got your nerve going down here. This is the lymph node that lives right between the pulmonary artery and the aorta. This, for example, is a level 9 lymph node. That's the one in the pulmonary ligament. The left lower lobe is retracted cephalate. We got the pericardium, the diaphragm, the spine, and the aorta right here. So the lymph node is being dissected and it's being removed. And again, used not only for diagnosis and staging, but can also render enough tissue for mutation studies. So we can do pleural biopsies. So patients that have an abnormal CT or PET scan and have tiny lesions that would be too difficult to try to biopsy with a needle, now we can go ahead and place a 5-millimeter camera and go in. And for example, this patient here had all these little abnormalities on the PET scan. You can see that on the surface of the lung has tumor, and then you can see these little tumor implants. So as opposed to just getting a small amount of tissue with a needle, we can go in with a biopsy forceps and we can remove this tumor. Or in this picture here, for example, in this movie here, we can see additional tumor in the diaphragm, in the parietal pleura. So we can put we use a forceps and then get a real chunk of tissue so we have as good amount of tissue as possible to ensure molecular testing. And we have VATS lobectomy. So this is the ultimate tissue procurement technique where we take out the entire tumor and not just a little piece of it. And I'll just show you a quick 1.5-minute lobectomy where the inferior pulmonary vein is dissected and then it's going to be transected with a stapling device. This is, again, another left lower lobe, retracted cephalate, the heart, the aorta, the spine, and all this is done through four small incisions. This is a stapling device taking down the pulmonary vein. The the use of lobectomy is very important now. There's a lot of studies that are looking at using TKIs in the neoadjuvant setting followed by surgery, and then other studies looking at the use of TKI of tyrosine kinase inhibitors in the adjuvant setting as opposed to chemotherapy. And this is for early stage lung cancers, not for advanced stage lung cancers. So you can see now how mutation status and treatment takes a part or is going to take a part in the care of the patient who's undergoing surgery for even early stage lung cancer. So let's talk about mutation analysis and tumor heterogeneity. So we talked about the ALK, KRAS, and EGFR mutations. But as I told you, first of all, not every patient is the same. And this is a concept that now we need to explain to our patients. There's something called tumor biology. And what the best way to explain this to our patients is that now we know that every lung cancer is different, just like every patient is different. Before, we try to put our patients into categories and stages. And we knew that if they had stage 1, they go to surgery, stage 2, surgery, maybe adjuvant treatment, stage 3, chemoradiation, stage 4, just chemotherapy. But now we know that every patient responds different based on their, I guess, mutation profile or mutation signature. And we have patients that have tumors that are found in the most advanced stages and have great treatment response and have a good survival with good quality of life years. We have patients who have the earliest stage lung cancer and they do poorly and they don't have a good survival. So now every patient is different. The interesting point here is that any given patient can have more than one mutation, and some of these mutations are positive, meaning the presence of the mutation conveys a response to treatment. Some of these mutations within the same tumor, for example, the one that I mentioned, the T790M, which is usually a sign of secondary resistance, but some patients can have this mutation or others initially. So you can have a combination of these, especially if you combine it with the ALK, for example, or a KRAS. And even in a patient that has metastatic lesions, the tumor marker profile of each metastasis can be different. This was well studied in patients with renal cell carcinoma, and now it's being looked into in patients lung cancer. Also, as I mentioned to you, if you look at the mutation pattern, EGFR in this case of patients, if you look at the mutation pattern in the primary tumor and in the metastasis, it may not be exactly the same. And this has a lot of implications in terms of treatment response. So where does surgery stand in this whole algorithm? Well, as mentioned to you, we used to use surgery for treatment, but now we use surgery for diagnosis, we use surgery for staging, we use surgery to procure tissue, and we can use surgery, if you think about it, to treat metastasis. If you have a patient that has oligometastasis, the patient is treated with a TKI, and most of the metastases go away, but there's one that doesn't go away, you can anticipate that metastasis probably has one of these point mutations that conveys resistance to TKI. Theoretically, you can offer that patient a resection. We've gotten so good with surgery in terms of morbidity and mortality that if you think about it as a way of treatment, surgery is actually less morbid than chemotherapy, for example. You got a patient that can recover from a wedge and can go home the next day. Obviously, you got to select your patients very carefully, but there's no reason why surgery could not be viewed as a way of treating a metastasis. So you get rid of the metastasis that is not responding to the treatment, and you can continue the patient on his regular TKI regimen. And now you have tissue that you can analyze again and look for different resistant conveying mutations. And then there's other agents that could be used, and the patient's regimen could be switched. So there's no reason why, as mentioned, a patient could undergo targeted treatment, and if the patient develops a resistance or a tumor that is not responding to the treatment and it's isolated, that patient could undergo to surgery now, which before, to take out a tumor in a patient with stage 4 lung cancer would be crazy. Nowadays, it shouldn't be that crazy. So to summarize, non-small cell lung cancer now is subdivided by its molecular mutation pattern. Surgery is safer, less invasive due to the technology and preoperative management. So, again, surgery should be thought as another way of treating advanced stage lung cancer, depending on the patient, depending on the mutation status. Surgical specimens are more valuable than before due to the heterogeneous nature of the genetic alterations, as mentioned. And surgery combined with drug therapy, post or preoperatively for select biomarkers, is something that we're looking at right now, and it's probably going to be part of the very near future. All this to try to personalize the treatment of the patient with lung cancer. And I don't be surprised if you're going to have to prescribe Coca-Cola for your patients. This just came out not long ago that Coca-Cola increases the drug, certain TKIs, bioavailability, so you can see how everything is changing so rapidly. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions. Thanks for your time. No questions? Great. Well, that's a great question. Stage 2 disease usually involves hilar lymph nodes. Is the PET scan sensitive enough? Well, the PET scan it is, 90%, but we know that 10% of PET scan results might not be accurate, and that's because not only tumor may light up on a PET scan, but inflammation, infection, or if you have a patient that has a tumor and post-obstructive pneumonia. So even in those patients, mediastinoscopy or another form of mediastinal staging, such as EBUS, is indicated. I don't know if that answers your question. It's part of our guidelines to go and diagnose the abnormality in the mediastinum, even though the PET scan is positive. So we need tissue confirmation. You could, however, we know that there's about a 12% chance of metastasis, even in the absence of abnormalities on the CT or PET scan. So depending on the clinical scenario, if you have a tumor, for example, or you have a patient that looks like a stage 1, meaning he has a tumor isolated or localized only to the lung, but if that tumor is in the middle or inner third of the lung field, we would do a staging procedure such as an EBUS and or mediastinoscopy, even though the PET scan is negative. as opposed to the patient that has a small tumor and that's peripheral with a negative PET CT, we know that those patients have a much less likelihood of having a positive or an abnormal mediastinum. So it kind of depends a little bit on the clinical scenario. All right. Thank you very much for your time.